Welcome back. For at least the last 15 years or so, within the national security world, there's been an awareness of the importance of cybersecurity, cyber warfare, cyber risk in general. And in the last year or two, especially, the rest of the broader public has caught up. Certainly 2011 was the year of the hack with so many high-profile incidents. And this year, there is Congress has caught up. There are a number of pieces of legislation under active consideration. Some will be on the floor of the House in April, and the Senate probably in May. So it's a great time to gather this distinguished panel to look at some of the issues around the proposed legislation and in general. I'll do introductions. There are in the online invite to this, which you probably all received, there are links to extended bios of all of the speakers from this morning and this afternoon. But I'll go right down the room here. Matthew Eggers is a senior director in the National Security and Emergency Preparedness Department of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He leads the Chamber's Cybersecurity Working Group, which focuses on advocating the Chamber's cyber policies before Congress and the administration. Next to him is Sharon Bradford Franklin. She's senior counsel at the Constitution Project. She works principally with the project's Bipartisan Liberty and Security Committee, seeking to protect American civil liberties as well as our nation's security post 9/11. Most recently, she worked with the committee to develop its recommendations for the implementation of a comprehensive and constitutional cybersecurity policy. Jamil Jaffer is senior counsel for the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and an adjunct professor of law at George Mason University. Before then, he served as an associate counsel to the president, assistant attorney general in the National Security Division, and counsel in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Policy. Mike Vadas was one of the really first people in public life to wrap his mind around some of these issues. He's now a partner at Steptoe & Johnson in the New York office, where his practice focuses on internet, e-commerce, privacy, data security issues. He was the founding director of the National Infrastructure Protection Center at the FBI, and that was the first government organization responsible for detecting, warning of, and responding to cyber attacks. Before that, he was Associate Deputy Attorney General for National Security Matters, and in that capacity, he helped lead the development of the nation's first policies regarding cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection. So thank you all for participating today, and thank you all for sharing your afternoon with us. So there are various acts in play right now. The Cybersecurity Act of 2012, the Secure IT Act, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, the PRECISE Act. Some have acronyms, others don't. But very broadly, let's start with the basics. What is it that these acts are designed? What's the threat they're designed to address? What's the scope and nature of it? And I'd like to just, we're not going to do a series of talks. This will all be hopefully a roundtable format. But I'll first ask Mike to address that question. What is it we're trying to protect against?
Well, there's a broad range of cyber threats that stem from, on the low-level side, what used to be called script kiddies, you know, hackers who hack for fun, like to prove their skills, all the way up to nation-state actors who pose a severe threat to our national security because of their ability to penetrate our networks and steal valuable defense information or technology information that they can use to catch up with us economically. And in between, you have groups that call themselves hacktivists or open government types, like WikiLeaks, that can publish information that can also be very damaging to our diplomatic relations, as has recently been demonstrated. Organized criminal groups that steal millions of credit cards and can also engage in identity theft that affect us on an individual basis. And so that, you know, that's part of the range of threats. And I used to talk about this range back in the 90s when I was in government dealing with this issue. And a lot of the response I got back then was, you know, this is really all just about the annoyance end of the spectrum, the script kiddies. This is not a real national security threat. You don't hear that anymore, I think, because there's much more of a recognition now that this is a national security issue. There are differences of opinion, as I'm sure you'll hear today, about what we should do about this national security aspect of the problem. But I think there's general consensus that this is a true national security issue. You've all been following the news, I'm sure, and every week there seems to be a new revelation about attacks that emanate from China. You know, it's hard to prove that it's the Chinese government that's involved, but it's not too easy. I mean, it's not too difficult to draw that conclusion given the sophistication of the penetrations and given the types of information that are being taken. And so the bills, I think, that are pending before Congress, in particular S-2105, which is the Lieberman-Collins bill, are really directed at the national security end of the spectrum. And, and that bill in particular is really the first one that proposes some sort of government regulation of cybersecurity across the board. We've got cybersecurity requirements under Gramm-Leach-Bliley for financial institutions and under HIPAA for health institutions, but they're sector limited, obviously, and they're also very limited in terms of what they accomplish. Lieberman-Collins is meant to address the national security end of things, and it, just in a very short summary, it would allow the Secretary of DHS to, in conjunction with industry and various sectors of the economy, to come up with performance requirements that industries that are designated to be covered critical infrastructures would have to meet. The performance requirements would be established by industry unless the industry just failed to do that, and then the secretary could come up with his or her own. And there would be requirements that industry live up to those performance measures, and if they don't, there would eventually, after a many-stage process, there would be the potential for civil action by the secretary to impose some sort of penalty. But again, this would be limited to covered critical infrastructures. There are dozens of ways out from under these requirements that we can get into in detail if you're interested. But this is really the first effort to address this, and I think it's because of a realization that, you know, we've been thinking about this problem now for well over a dozen years, but have really failed, utterly failed, to make any progress in dealing with it. The threat has outrun our defense efforts by miles. And if we don't do anything serious about this, we're going to face major, major problems, not just espionage of military technology and things like that, but a devastating, destructive attack on our electrical power grids, on our communications network, on our financial institutions that don't just cause inconveniences, but can bring our economy to its knees.
So, Mike, would you agree that Stuxnet really was a game-changing event a couple of years ago? That was the malware that shut down, not to some level, affected the Iranian nuclear reactors.
I think that's a good point. It probably is, even though you know, I think all of us would agree that that was likely the product of the good guys. I think it showed people that there is a real power here through cyber means to have a destructive effect, you know, very sophisticated attack that was able to spread around the globe, but ultimately, you know, through various systems, but ultimately hit its target, which were specific Siemens computers that the Iranians used in their uranium enrichment facilities. And, you know, so if the good guys can do that, there's no reason to believe that the bad guys can't do something very similar, but less targeted and against us.
Is it also true that, you know, now that that virus is in the wild, that, you know, although you may have been very intelligent to design it, you don't have to be so smart to replicate it?
Unless it was designed in such a way that it's hard to reverse engineer or build upon, and I just don't, you know, I haven't Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's the case, but you know, that risk is a good example of the potential for blowback that comes from, you know, developing our own offensive cyber capabilities. And one of the reasons I think we haven't really deployed those capabilities very much, if at all, is that we haven't figured out how you deal with the blowback or the secondary and tertiary effects. You know, if we take down an adversary's electrical power temporarily because we want to shut down their anti-aircraft capability leading up to a kinetic strike, you know, what effect does that have on civilian hospitals and things like that, or on the financial institutions in that country, and you know, which will have ripple effects onto our own financial institutions. So these are a lot of the sort of problems I think that have thwarted our willingness to deploy these weapons on our own.
Any thoughts from the other panelists about the nature of the threat or the responses to it?
Well, I think certainly Mike's right to warn us of the threat of a catastrophic attack on our critical infrastructure. But one of the things that we also have to keep in mind is the sort of day-in, day-out siphoning of U.S. Intellectual property. So my boss, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, likes to say that there are two kinds of companies left in America today: those who have been hacked and know it, and those that have been hacked and just don't know it yet. And what's happening day in, day out, is that foreign companies and foreign, oftentimes foreign government actors, as Mike points out, it's hard to attribute things directly to foreign governments, but there's a lot of writing on the wall, are day in and day out stealing the very intellectual property that's at the heart of the American economy. The billions of dollars that our economy spends, that companies in our economy spend on developing new and innovative solutions, what really drives the engine, the economic engine that is America, are going right out the back door through computer systems. And that's a real problem. It's a real problem both in the near term for companies whose intellectual property has already been stolen, and it's a problem in the long term as our economy shifts more and more to a technology-based economy. And so that's a real problem. And that's a problem that's happening today, day in, day out. While your mileage may vary on when you think the next big cyber attack is going to happen, and it almost certainly is going to come at some point, what you can say with complete assurance is that today billions of dollars are being stolen out of our economy as a result of the theft of intellectual property off of corporate computer systems.
Yeah, I might offer that I think there's a lot of agreement on the nature of the threats: national governments, terrorists or potentially terrorists, industrial spies, organized criminals, hacktivists, hackers. You've got the insider threat. All of those kinds of threats are generally well known among folks that look at this issue. Now, I think Congress is taking a very active role in this. They've been looking at ways to address a very serious and growing problem for at least 3 years. I'll probably go into a little bit of the regulatory issue with respect to one or more of the bills in a moment, but I think you've got a number of committees on both sides looking at the best way to address this issue. I think, at least from the chamber's perspective, we take this issue very seriously. And we're always looking for the best ways to impart to our members the kinds of things that they need to do to protect their information, protect their systems, know the kinds of information that they've got on their networks, and take appropriate actions to secure that data. I think in terms of where we are, we've got two chambers of Congress kind of primed in the near run to take action. I think they're going to probably take some steps very soon to do so. At least from the chamber's perspective, we think that the threats need to be addressed. It's just a matter of how you go about that, that take into consideration issues related to the right decisions and the right kinds of resources that you want to bring to bear to the problem.
Sharon, anything on this?
I would agree with that type of a framework. The threat, my colleagues have talked about a bit, but the issue before Congress now is that existing law doesn't really allow the government and the private sector to work together in ways that they need to do to best protect our networks, both government networks and private networks. But we want to make sure we do this in a smart manner to upfront, as we're establishing these new authorities and new rules, build in the appropriate safeguards, as I'll have a chance to talk to you about a little bit more as we go forward.
Now, one of the common themes through most of the legislative proposals is the need for information sharing, government to private, private to government, private to private. And as part of that, some level of limitations of liability further for private actors who do share or receive that information. Could you address those for a bit, Jamil?
Sure. I think that, today the government has in its hands a lot of information about the threat the nation faces, or at least particularly the threat that the government faces from cyber hackers, from foreign cyber hackers. There is no way, no functional way today under existing law for the government to share a lot of that information, some of which is highly classified, with the private sector in a usable form. As a result, the private industry is not protected for the things the government has already protected itself against. So that's a problem. Beyond that, the government itself makes up a very small portion of the public-facing internet. And as a result, the government only knows what it sees coming at its systems. It has no idea what's attacking sort of the rest of America. Now, if corporate America were willing to share some of that information on a voluntary basis with the government could better provide more classified information back to the private sector to help it protect itself. What you don't want is the government out there collecting information about what's going up against private networks, nor do you want the government out there protecting private networks. You want the private sector to protect itself, right? But you want it to be able to do that enhanced with the information the government has. If the government can provide better information, so much the better. You also want industry to be able to talk to each other, folks in the private sector to talk to each other without fear that they're going to be prosecuted or without fear they're going to run afoul of various communications laws to protect each other in the cybersecurity realm, right? And to share best practices, to share threat information and the like. And so what you really need is a much more robust information sharing environment, and the way to do that is to provide protection in the law to allow people to engage in that type of sharing. Right? You don't want to mandate, there are different views on whether you ought to mandate information sharing back to the government or not, but you certainly want to promote information sharing within the private sector to the government, and certainly the government to the private sector, where the government knows about threats that are coming at it, and yet it doesn't have the capability to share that with the private sector in a usable form. So I think that's where it's at the crux of the debate. And the question is, how much do you want shared? How do you want it shared? What are the protections in place to ensure that privacy and civil liberties are protected, right? And what are the protections in place to ensure the government doesn't misuse any information that's shared even with them on a voluntary basis? And so I think those are the areas of debate. I think you'll see that all of the bills before Congress today, whether you're talking about Lieberman-Collins in the Senate, or the Senate Republicans, the McCain legislation in the Senate, or in the House, the Rogers-Rupersberger Information Sharing Bill, or the Lundgren Bill. All those bills share in common, I think, these three facets. Information out from the government, information on a voluntary basis back to the government, although, again, there's some variance there, and information between the private sector to better protect, to better allow people to protect their own networks.
Go ahead.
And I might offer up, Jamil's probably just being a little bit humble in the sense that his boss's bill has got extraordinary support. I think last week it got well over 100 co-sponsors in the House. I don't know of a comparable bill that's reached that point. I think one of the things that we've been advocating, you've probably seen our maybe correspondence to the Hill and so forth, is we've said the prudent path forward is an information sharing bill just like Jamil outlined. We've been advocating, at least in the private sector, for a long time, hey, we want more information from government, create a sort of a common operating picture, know more what the threats are, how we can defend our networks and so forth, and to partner better. But I think one of the things, kind of call it the trifecta of kind of protections is, as I think he outlined, is information that's voluntarily shared, and in the process of protecting your networks, you'd have protection from liability, no frivolous lawsuits, in other words. That information, that sensitive information that you entrust to government or other private sector partners would be protected from disclosure. You don't want that vulnerability out, the vulnerable information out there so people can take it, use it against your system, your entity. Lastly, members say, we want to give information to the government. We do want to be helpful. We just don't want that information coming back to bite us, let's say, in a regulatory context. That's a third key thing that that bill does, provides protection from regulatory purposes.
Is it true that some of the bills would penalize someone who had information stolen to a greater extent than they would penalize the people who actually did the stealing? And some of the fines, fines contemplated in some of the statutes can be really prohibitive.
Yeah. I'd take a stab at it. There's a number of bills in terms of the framework. In terms of that specific provision, I'm not aware of any. I think there's provisions in there about the kinds of protections you need to take as an entity to protect information, cyber threat information that you're given or that you give. But in terms of fines, I'm not aware of anything in particular.
So look, I mean, there's a robust debate in Congress about whether the government ought to regulate folks into compliance with cybersecurity, some sort of standards or laws that are set out, or whether it makes sense to simply provide the information, step aside, see what happens, and then decide whether or not to regulate. Of course, in the regulatory space, regulations mean little if you're going to regulate without some sort of penalties. And I do believe that some of the bills, I think Mike mentioned the Lieberman-Collins bill, involve some regulatory pieces to them. And those regulations mean little if they don't come with some teeth. So if you believe a regulatory framework is necessary, then you want to have teeth in them. Now, the measure of how much of a penalty you might put in, how that might take place, whether it's through including provisions to allow people to sue or actual government penalties or allow the government to sue, there's a range of thoughts you might have on that. Once you've decided the right approach is to regulate. And so I'm not sure about the details of how it all plays out, but I think that's sort of the big debate on the Hill, both in the House and the Senate.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's really the crux of the issue right now. Everybody agrees on the need for information sharing. Everybody agrees that industry should have the primary responsibility for bolstering its own computer network defenses. The question is whether industry left to its own, aided by information sharing about the threats, is going to be enough to get us there. I would submit, based on our experience since 1995, that's not going to happen. Hasn't happened yet, and it's not going to happen. Information sharing has been something the government and the private sector have been working on since 95, at least, and there's a lack of information sharing. And I would also submit to you that's not because of deficiencies in the law. It's more on the government side. There's a practical issue: how do you share classified information with a large number of people in the private sector without having that information leaked to our adversaries? Especially when many of these corporations that you're sharing with are foreign owned, or at least have substantial percentage of foreign ownership. That's a practical problem, and there's no easy solution to that. But it's not a legal issue. In terms of information sharing with the government by private industry, there are perhaps some things you can do, like making sure that there's no liability. But I don't think that's the actual issue. I think the issue is more the issue is being raised as a way of diverting us from regulation. That's my take on it. And again, it comes from the same proposals being raised in the mid to late 90s.
Sarah, do you have any comment on that?
So we're agnostic from a civil liberties perspective on the regulation versus not regulation issue, because that doesn't really raise the civil liberties issue. The way that Jamil framed the information sharing approach at that high level, I would agree with completely that that's appropriate. You want to make sure we have safe channels for the government to share this threat information with the private sector, and the information flow in that direction, again, doesn't really raise any civil liberties concerns for us. But with the information flow coming back to the government, again, that's something we want to make sure is possible and legal, but that's where we really need to build in the safeguards. The risk is that you basically have a new perpetual government wiretap of all of our private communications. Now, I don't want to suggest for a moment that any of the four bills would go that far or create that world, but that's the evil we're trying to protect against. And we want to make sure that we don't basically have this as a time lag. So, yes, it's going through the private companies. They're the ones that are turning it over to the government. But if they're basically turning over everything for every purpose to the government, then you do effectively just have a perpetual wiretap with a time lag. So I'd like to talk a little bit more as we go forward about how we prevent that from happening and how we have an appropriate information sharing structure.
Sure, and we'll do that. Any other thoughts about either the liability limitations or the information sharing structure?
Well, on liability limitations, we haven't gotten into the weeds on that. We recognize that some level of liability protection is needed in order for that to be a realistic option for the private companies to share the information back with the federal government. Some of my colleagues in the civil liberties world who focus on private sector more, we as the Constitution Project focus more on what the government does, have some concerns about in some of the bills about how broad those liability limitations may be and whether they give too much safe harbor to some of the private sector. But I have to say that that's not something we've really taken a position on.
You know, I was just going to throw in there that, not surprisingly, that we think information sharing is the right sort of first step forward. I think we need to kind of jog before we run. I think we do think that at least the members that I interact with on a regular basis, we don't necessarily see getting, let's say, an information sharing bill through Congress as an easy off-ramp away from regulation. In fact, I think a number of advocates for the regulatory approach think that their concept is sound. We can get into that a little bit, but I think that there's, I think, legitimate interest, or at least legitimate questions that should be raised in terms of assuming that a program that would be set up would be implemented effectively. I think one of the most problematic things that I think would happen if we did set up a program such as under the Lieberman-Collins bill, and I'm sure I'll go into this in a little bit further in a moment, is that we enact a bill, it's not implemented effectively, businesses are contributing vast amount of resources to adhere to compliance. They're pulling from a pool of monies that say, hey, I've got to devote monies to both compliance and monies that I'm going to do real security. And then we've got to come back every 2 to 3 years and embrace a program that may not be working effectively. We've got to come back and say, hey, this is a program that needs to be continued. There is no clinical study that I can be that I'm aware of that says that some of the proposals that are being put forward would be effective.
So, Sharon, you began to touch on this, but now if you could give us some sense of whether any of these proposals raise, I'll use the term broadly, privacy concerns that you'd like to see addressed and how.
Absolutely. The answer is they all do. They all have this information share. All the lead bills, the two lead bills in the Senate and as well as in the House, have this information sharing approach, which, as I mentioned, the information flow out from the government sharing risk information, you want to make sure safe channels for that. That doesn't raise civil liberties concerns. But when the information is coming back to the government, yes, we got a hit with that threat information you shared with us or other vulnerabilities that they want to share back to the government. That's where there are very serious civil liberties risks. And the answer, though, is not to prohibit that. You want to set that up and have that channel. The answer is to make sure to really build in robust safeguards from the get-go. And Constitution Project's report, which was by our bipartisan Liberty and Security Committee, folks with backgrounds in all three branches of government across the political spectrum, and hopefully you picked up a copy, makes recommendations for three broad categories of safeguards. First and foremost is robust oversight. We have this new program. We want to make sure we're getting it right and have continued monitoring. And there, all of the bills rely on an entity that some of you may have heard of called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. Well, that could be fabulous. That board was created in its current form by Congress in 2007 and is supposed to have jurisdiction to review the civil liberties implications of national security policies. Bills talk about it having annual Jamil's boss's bill talks about it having annual audits with a public report, which is terrific. The problem is that board doesn't exist right now. We only just in December of this year got a full slate of five nominees from President Obama. And only just yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee finally announced they're going to actually have confirmation hearings on those nominees. So that's a great step. I hope that we will have the board up and running soon. But as you all know, with the recent controversies over confirmations, that is far from a sure bet. Since we can't at this point say we're going to have a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board anytime in the imminent future, we need to make sure that there are other provisions to backstop that for effective oversight. Regular reports to Congress. We have recommended in our report, that we have annual audits by the inspectors general of the relevant agencies, again with public reports. So we need to make sure that those provisions are robust and meaningful. If we can get the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board established, that would be fabulous too. The second broad category is to have rigorous privacy safeguards. And here I'm talking about when the information is coming into the government, to the greatest extent possible, we should be keeping out the personally identifiable information about individuals. So when companies, such particularly internet service providers, are turning over information, if it's not necessary for the cybersecurity purpose or a necessary part of that cyber threat information that's being turned over, to excise that personally identifiable information, or PII. And the bills vary on how good their safeguards are for that. The Lieberman-Collins bill in the Senate is much better than the Rogers bill in the House. It requires reasonable efforts to take out the PII when it's not a necessary component of it before the information is turned over. And we don't. The House bill has a provision where you could have anonymization requested by the company turning it over, but it's not even clear if that just means, don't tell them I'm Verizon who gave you this information, rather than taking out your customer's PII, and it's not mandatory or even saying anything about reasonable efforts. The third category is to have really strict use limitations. And this is, we're establishing this broad new surveillance program where the government is going to be sweeping up all this information, admittedly coming voluntarily from the private sector. And this is something that Secretary Chertoff was talking about at the end of the Q&A a bit. We want to make sure that this is focused on the cybersecurity purpose. The whole point of this legislation is for cybersecurity. That's the use to which this information should be put. And we need to make sure we have some very strong use limitations in there. So, for example, if Verizon is sending over its emails because there seem to be some malware attached and so forth, government gets it and they're looking at this and turns out to be innocuous or maybe not, but says, looks like this particular email user, something suspicious with the finances. Maybe there's some tax fraud going over there. Let's send it over to the IRS and see what's going on. Well, in our view, that's not really appropriate. This is a cybersecurity program. So we've recommended that the information, if it's shared once the government gets it, it should be for a cybersecurity purpose. And if it's shared with law enforcement, it should be for a cyber crime. Or if it's an unrelated crime, there should be probable cause of the unrelated crime and not for any purpose. Both bills are problematic. Both of the lead bills, the Lieberman-Collins and the Rogers bill, are problematic from our perspective. The House bill, Rogers bill, H.R. 3523, did include a manager's amendment when it was passed out of committee, which moved in the right direction. I want to give credit for that. But it still says information can be used once the federal government gets its hands on it. It can be shared as long as at least one significant purpose is cybersecurity or protection of national security. So maybe that would cut out your tax fraud example, but those are still, from our perspective, huge loopholes. I think of Secretary Chertoff's example of not wanting, you monitor the recycling program. Well, I know a lot of environmentalists have talked about, climate change and global warming is the next big national security threat. So, that's obviously an extreme example, but it's not too hard to package something to say that at least one purpose is national security or cybersecurity. So we'd like to see that narrowed. And on the Senate side, for sharing with law enforcement, again, it's a low bar. It can be shared with law enforcement if the information appears to relate to a crime which has been, is being, or is about to be committed. So that's not even your reasonable suspicion kind of standard. So those are the three categories of safeguards we'd like to see incorporated into these bills.
So I think Sharon and I share a lot of common ground on this, and I think the chairman and the ranking member, you know, this is the Rogers-Ruppersberger bill, I should note, jointly introduced by the chairman and ranking member of our committee, passed out of the committee on a 17-1 bipartisan vote, has over 100 bipartisan co-sponsors, so it's hardly a Republican or Rogers-only bill. But I would note, first of all, on the first point about inspector generals, we actually share the concern that Sharon has raised that there is no Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board today. We did in our initial bill that was, or the chairman's bill and ranking member's bill that was introduced, had the PCLOB. At the time, as Sharon points out, only two people had been nominated by the administration. Interestingly, an entity that actually was stood up and functioning in the Bush administration had only had two nominees nominated in this administration. Now they have five. But as a result, we accepted a committee, an amendment from Mr. Thompson from California, a Democrat from California, to replace the PCLOB with the inspector general, with an independent inspector general review, annual report submitted to Congress, outlining a specific set of criteria that the inspector general had to review and report to Congress on, to include issues related to privacy and civil liberties, and to include recommendations to Congress to address any concerns related to privacy and civil liberties. So I think we've checked that box in terms of the inspector general review that Sharon and folks in the community were looking for, and we did that in committee. On the second piece of the information being shared, well, let me jump to the third piece, which is the purpose to which information might be used. You know, the last thing you want the federal government doing is creating a wall, right, and saying, I've got this information, but I can't share it with these other people because I'm barred from doing that, right? I mean, we learned the lesson. Mike can tell you, we've learned the lesson about that 9/11. Right, where information was collected for intelligence purposes, couldn't be shared with law enforcement folks. And as a result, I think if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, I think it's pretty clear that there was information that could have been used by the government but wasn't, because it wasn't shared across that transom. Even though procedures actually permitted to be shared, it wasn't shared effectively. So I think the thing you don't want to do is create a wall. At the same time, I think we recognize that Sharon's right. You don't want to just let the government sort of have a field day with this. And as a result, with information that's voluntarily shared, I wouldn't call this a surveillance program. It certainly, if it were a surveillance program, it's a pretty poor surveillance program by the government, since nobody's required to give anything back to the government, nor can the government, under our legislation, one of the amendments we adopted in committee, amendment actually recommended by the Center for Democracy and Technology, a provision that would prevent the government from tasking anybody to provide information back to it. And we actually added, the chairman and ranking member actually added an additional provision onto that, which said the government can't say to you, hey, if you don't give me information back, I won't give you any of my classified intelligence information. So the government can't do that either. It can't engage in a quid pro quo. So we put provisions, the chairman and the ranking member put provisions into this bill to address those concerns, as well as the use limitation that Sharon referred to. So we think we've tried to address a lot of these concerns about how the information's used by the government when it gets it. With respect to information when it's coming into the government and whether you anonymize or minimize it, strip out personally identifiable information, the bill that the chair mentioned, the Rogers-Ruppersberger bill, does provide for authority to the private sector to anonymize or minimize the information, which is to say redact out information that is provided to the government. And remember, this is a purely voluntary regime. On the day if this bill were ever enacted by Congress and signed into law by the president, nobody has to share a single thing. And if they decide to share, they can share two pieces of information or no pieces of information, or you know, a large amount of information. Nothing is required. And as a result, it makes sense to require them to decide, the industry and people who are sharing information, to decide what's anonymized and what's minimized in order to protect the privacy of their patrons, right? And so that's sort of the way that the bill approaches this. As I say, it got broad support in committee, coming out 17-1. I think in this Congress, it's hard to point to any bills that come out 17-1 or have a broad bipartisan co-sponsorship, and I think the chairman and ranking member are really pleased with that result.
How would you, though, compare that? Well, Sharon began by saying that the two main bills were Lieberman-Collins and Rogers-Ruppersberger.
Well, I think McCain would, and Bailey might, who've offered an alternative in the Senate, might have a different view on that. How would you compare the information sharing provisions of your bill with the McCain-Bailey bill?
So, you know, we've worked very closely with both the Lieberman-Collins folks as well as the McCain folks, the Hutchinson and Chambliss folks in developing their bills. And I think when we began this process, the only sort of document out there was the administration's proposal. And then that proposal dealt largely with some small measure of voluntary information sharing between the government and the private sector, from the private sector back to the government, and did not address at all classified information out to the private sector, and did not address at all private-to-private sharing. And if you look at all the bills across the spectrum now, whether you're talking about Rogers-Ruppersberger in the House, Lundgren in the House, Lieberman-Collins in the Senate, McCain, Hutchinson, Chambliss in the Senate, they all cover the same ground. Classified information out from the government, information between the private sector, between private sector entities, and information back to the government. And so I think that, at least in that sense, they share a common framework. The way you do it, what protections you have in place, what you permit, what you don't permit, what you minimize or don't minimize, what you provide liability for or don't, all vary in some level, but they all share a common basis, which is that it makes sense for the government to push information out, makes sense for the government to get information back either on a voluntary or mandatory basis, and it makes sense for the industry to share its own best practices and threat information amongst itself.
I characterize it that way based on what we're hearing about what will be the base bill when they come to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, absolutely, there are four bills, two lead in the Senate and two lead in the House. And I would say that actually the other lead bill in the House, H.R. 3674, main sponsor being Representative Lundgren, is probably the most protective of civil liberties. It has the narrowest definition of what information can be shared with the government, really saying that the information has a requirement of stripping the PII from it, and talking about the information being necessary to describe a cyber threat in order for the information to be shared in the first place. One other difference among these bills that it's of concern to us is what part of the government or what entity receives this information when it comes in. From our perspective, we'd like to make sure that this is a civilian agency. We're talking about our civilian private networks. The Lieberman-Collins bill has at least the lead agency as the Department of Homeland Security, which is certainly the lead agency for protecting the federal civilian networks. It is now responsible for the main pilot program that has been going on with the public-private information sharing involving the defense industrial base companies. Department of Homeland Security has a pretty good track record with a strong privacy office that has done a lot of privacy impact assessments and demonstrated it, understands how to build in safeguards and keep track of these issues and do the auditing of the privacy concerns. And so I think we have a lot greater comfort level with that being at the hub. The Lundgren bill creates this entity called NISO, or the National Information Sharing Organization, which would be kind of a public-private hub. I don't have any view as to that being better or worse than Department of Homeland Security, but in both of those cases, we would have a civilian agency at the hub as receiving the information, which is really important to ensure. The other two bills, McCain being the lead sponsor of the Senate bill and the Rogers-Ruppersberger in the House, have more scope for the military agencies being the recipient of the private sector information coming in, which is another concern of ours.
Well, so I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as more scope. Our bill just doesn't say where you have to come into. So you can come into the government. If you as a private sector entity are most comfortable coming to the FBI, you can do that. If you're most comfortable coming to DHS, you can do that. If you're comfortable coming to the Department of Agriculture, you can do that. It's all about letting people pick and choose where they come into the government. Right? Once information's in the government, right, obviously the government can and should robustly share information and ensure that everyone has full situational awareness. But you know, it didn't seem, at least to us on the front end, to enshrine where industry comes in the law. And so I think it's not a fair characterization to say that our legislation requires you to come in or provides more scope. It simply is that the bill simply doesn't speak to the question of where industry might want to come in. And again, people's mileage may vary. You know, there are folks who feel more comfortable coming to one agency over another. And you also don't want necessarily force people to all come in through one door, right? That requires people to incur large costs to shift their current infrastructure. They may have already created a mechanism for sharing information with one entity or another. It seems odd to sort of require them to come in yet again through yet another federal government-created organization or hub or entity. And so I think that was sort of the approach that my boss and the ranking member took with respect to the legislation.
I don't want to hijack this. Two quick responses. One, happy to have multiple points of entry as long as they're civilian. And the second is, you're talking about the choice of the private industry, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I, as the consumer, as the user of the internet service provider or other, you know, at the consumer level, are making that choice. So in terms of having the safeguards for the personally identifiable information of the actual consumers, we would like to see it be a civilian agency.
Matthew, Mike?
I was just going to throw in there that I think they laid out kind of the framework and the processes well. I was just going to add, one of the things that we've stressed as we've looked at and assessed the number of the bills that have the information sharing components is we like the fact that, for example, the Rogers-Ruppersberger bill, among others, uses existing institutions. It doesn't try to stand up anything new. I think one of the things that we hear continually from members across multiple sectors is, we don't want to stand up anything new. We're going to have to duplicate existing things like information sharing and analysis centers, or ISACs, that have respective entities in each sector, be it banking, electric, comms, what have you, IT. And you don't want to displace some of the efforts, some of the people and capital resources people are putting into those institutions, including entities at DHS, among others.
Maybe I can just offer a thought experiment of sorts to put this in perspective. We don't rely on the private sector for our ballistic missile defense. We don't say, for example, all right, we're not going to have NORAD anymore detecting whether ICBMs are coming from Russia or China or somewhere else. Instead, we're going to have Sarah Palin and her neighbors in Alaska let us know if they see Russian bombers or lobstermen in Maine in the North Atlantic. Just voluntarily report to us whether those are coming in. We don't rely on the private sector to do border control. Diners or gas stations near the border to phone the federal government or state and locals if they see someone suspicious coming in for a bite to eat or to fill up their tank of gas. Those are quintessential governmental functions. I think I would venture to say everyone or nearly everyone in this room, whatever your political leanings, would agree those are governmental functions. I think probably all of us would agree, too, that we're more likely to experience a devastating cyber attack than we are to experience a devastating nuclear attack in the near to midterm. And so the question is, if all those things are true, then why are we relying on voluntary information sharing as our principal means of defense against a national security threat? I think there are some explanations. The fact is that the same pipes that carry foreign-based threat to our national security are the same ones that carry our personal communications and things like that. But that still begs the question of whether this is whether it's appropriate and adequate to the threat to rely on voluntary information sharing to do the work of our defense for us. In my personal opinion, the way to deal with this problem, the way to alleviate the burden on private industry and also the threat to civil liberties, is to have government more directly involved in monitoring for threats, but very carefully circumscribe what it can do with the information. So if we have civil liberties qualms about people being investigated for things unrelated to national security, whether it's tax fraud or anything else, then draw those lines in legislation and say you cannot use the information you glean from monitoring internet traffic for this list of purposes, or do it the reverse way, more positively. You may only use this information for these purposes, and draw the lines there rather than saying the government cannot be involved in directly monitoring systems. As I said, that also alleviates the private sector from the burden of having to monitor systems If we agree it's a national security issue and it's a governmental function rather than a private sector function to defend ourselves.
Well, I think our bill takes a very clear view on that. It is not a governmental function to monitor the internet, nor should it be. We believe that to the extent that private sector companies want to defend themselves, they ought to do it. They ought to do it enhanced with government information. And to the extent they want to voluntarily share information with the government, they ought to do that too. But certainly deploying, as we do at the border, or as we do with ballistic missile defense, deploying government agents to watch the private sector internet is not something that that I think the chairman or the ranking member are supportive of, nor do I think we would have gotten a 17-1 bipartisan vote or bipartisan co-sponsorship of any legislation that would permit that. So, you know, maybe an interesting thought experiment, but it's not something that we are interested in or in the business of doing, at least from where we're coming from.
Let me at least maybe continue with the thought experiment. I think we've got two different things sort of being dealt with here. You've got a Lieberman-Collins bill that would take the kind of sector-based risk assessments that we've actually called for, but more truly on along the lines of a collaborative way, and then having a alternative approach that would have, let's say, an entity of government, DOD, NSA, some agency or department such as that have a more direct role. Now, let me put out there that Chamber doesn't have a policy on what role NSA, DOD should play. But let's be clear, there are two different things going on here. One, with Lieberman-Collins, you need to comply with certain performance requirements, and a number of costs and trade-offs come with that. There's another issue with respect to having more assistance, if you will, from entities in government. That's an entirely different issue.
Yeah, well, let's sort of shift into that regulatory discussion. And I'm going to ask the question a little provocatively. Broadly, a couple of years ago, the government asked folks in the energy sector, the companies, to identify their critical assets. And to a surprising degree, the answer that came back was, we don't have any. It took a Cambridge University graduate student to map out 10,000 industrial control systems that were accessible through the public internet last May to maybe get some folks to rethink that. And so some would say that because it's not a profit, because utilities, for example, are profit-making enterprises, and there's not of, it's expensive to do cybersecurity, to do it right, that private industry is just failing to do what it has to do, and therefore a broader, more robust regulatory structure is necessary. I can see Matt fuming as I say that, so go ahead.
That line of argument is not new to me. I don't think the private sector is failing. I think that entities within the private sector weren't initially stood up to kind of deflect, defeat cyber attacks from foreign entities, well-resourced industrial spies, organized crime, hacktivists. Heck, the government has breaches of its defenses, its networks. The best of the best out there are getting hacked, having data exfiltrated, private sector and government. We all share the same problem. The main point is, what are we going to do about it that actually helps? One of the key things that we try to communicate when we're, let's say, on Capitol Hill talking with staff and members is, are you asking the question, what would actually help you? If I may, let me just kind of take the liberty of walking through some of the core concerns that we would have with the lead regulatory bill in the Senate, the Lieberman-Collins bill. And let me say, for example, that the bill has about 200-plus pages. It's got a number of elements that we actually like: promoting information sharing, facilitating international norms, and R&D, but the beating heart consists of a regulatory approach. Let me just kind of, if you bear with me for a second, let me tick off a few. Section 102, the bill would require DHS to conduct sector-by-sector risk assessments considering matters such as the actual or assessed threat, including adversary capabilities. There's more requirements related to that. And by the way, DHS would submit these risk assessments in a classified or unclassified form to the president, appropriate federal agencies, and congressional committees. I don't know if some of you are with companies and so forth, but that would put a lot of your sensitive information potentially at risk for being publicly disclosed. Section 103, the assessments of companies by sector are meant to tee up or designate whether a company's systems or assets, and those are the two key things that are being looked at, are covered critical infrastructure, what you'll hear is CCI. Parenthetically, you'll be pleased to know that if a company disagrees with the designations, you're allowed to appeal to a federal court. Sections 104 and 105, I'll be finished in a second. The designation of CCI is just the start. DHS must also develop cybersecurity performance requirements for each sector, as we've noted, requiring owners who would be consulted with to mitigate any identified risks. And then you'd have to promulgate regulations to carry out these activities. You've got to certify to DHS annually that you are implementing security measures that satisfy these regs, or submit a third-party assessment. And you know what? I'm only at page 25 of the bill. Page 25 features enforcement provisions. I read an op-ed in the New York Times a couple days ago saying that these performance requirements are non-compulsory. You don't have to do it. Really? Enforcement provisions, including providing for civil penalties for critical infrastructures that fail to adhere to the regulations. Still just page 25 of a 200-page bill. In short, the bill would allow DHS to regulate a wide number of critical infrastructures, from banking to water, businesses, the people that know how to protect their networks best would be compelled to focus on compliance as opposed to security. And we think, you know, check the box, security certification regimes won't be able to keep up. Who thinks really we're going to be able to keep up with the rapidly changing threats? Most of my members will say, hey, anything we're going to be asked to do, we've already thought of it. Make no mistake, I think it would cost businesses a considerable sum. And that's not the only thing to cost. It's the decision-making processes. Not to mention, we really haven't had a cost assessment of what it would cost the federal government to do this. Last point, and I'll finish, is how do we know why we could, should, just question the basic assumption that this program would be implemented effectively? Well, one of the other issues I handle is the Chemical Security Program, also known as CFATS. The program's been in existence for a number of years. Many millions of dollars have been devoted to that program. Not a single site security plan has been approved. One of the challenges that we've faced is the advocates of the regulatory approach say, it's going to be flexible. You get to have a lot of decision-making authority in terms of how these standards are implemented. But we've got things related to inherently safer technologies, how a background check of a facility would be implemented to tell us that it wouldn't necessarily be flexible. You would be told essentially what to do. I'll finish.
Anything, Michael? No? No? Fair, is a fair comment that, you know, by the time something has made its way into the CFR, the hackers and are 10 generations beyond it? I think that's the argument, right? But the delay in the regulatory structure makes it all but useless. So.
I don't think that's necessarily fair with respect to Lieberman-Collins because it sets performance requirements. It doesn't say what technology you're supposed to use. In fact, it specifically says that the performance requirements and the regulation can't specify particular technologies. And it's up to industry to develop the means by which it will comply with the performance requirements. Now, I think it is a fair question to ask, what is a performance requirement? How do you define a performance requirement? And I don't believe the legislation speaks to that. So there's a lot of discretion. It's a big open question about what is a performance requirement. How specific will it be?
Let me just throw out there that the program, the chemical security program, and I'm not just criticizing the program to have fun or to take shots at the program or the or the department, because I think they're doing their best to implement it. I think we're just trying to basically raise a legitimate question. Yes, with the CFADS program, too, you're allowed to have flexibility in meeting those performance requirements. But when Congress comes back in to reauthorize that program, what do they try to do? They try to come back in there with provisions related to saying, covered facilities, you must use this process or procedure. So one of the things that's concerned me most about this isn't that I think Senators Lieberman and Collins and other advocates have it out for the business community. They don't. What we're concerned about is that you create this program, and then after it's established, you can come in after the fact and inject things in there that would be very prescriptive and not helpful. And I come back to the point. I know people want to do things, but are they asking the questions to business? What would help you?
So, you know, in the Intelligence Committee, we have the benefit of not having to sort of get involved in the regulatory debate, whether to regulate or not regulate. The focus of the chairman of the ranking member's bill is very narrow. And, you know, whether you regulate or don't regulate might be dependent upon your view of whether or not there is a market failure. But there's a robust debate, I think, in Congress about whether there is or is not a market failure, and if there is, what you do about it. But what I think everyone on this panel can agree, and I think what all the bills agree with, and there's a broad bipartisan consensus with in Congress, is that whether or not there's a market failure, there's an information failure. The government isn't sharing what it knows. Private industry isn't able to effectively share within industry what it knows. And to the extent it's comfortable doing it, it doesn't feel comfortable today because of the legal superstructure sharing information back to the government. And as a result, at the very least, whether you think you ought to regulate or not regulate, I think everybody agrees, you've got to do something to get past this issue of information sharing. And at least let that flourish and happen. And whether you regulate or not, separate issue. But at the very least, information ought to be shared.
Now, in the regulatory framework, there's a couple of related questions. One is DHS really up to the task? I mean, can they do anything? And then that leads you to a very controversial question, and that is what, if any, should be the role of the National Security Agency in cybersecurity? You can't help but notice that the NSA hires more mathematicians than anybody in the world, it's said, and has the best computer talent in the world, it's said, although it's hard to imagine how that works with given all the money that can be made legally or illegally in the private sector on the computer side. With all that, what should the role of the NSA... Let me mention, it's interesting that Google, when it had a serious problem, who did they call? They called the NSA. Now, the argument could well be that what they really wanted from the NSA was permissions to violate the laws of a dozen countries to trace something back. But in any event, there was a case of a public-private partnership for sure. Question, what should be the role of the NSA in all of this? Anyone?
Well, I can offer the menu of options and then let other people decide what they should be. Currently the NSA is responsible not just for signals intelligence, but also for maintaining the security of classified systems in the government. That latter part of the mission could theoretically be extended to the private sector in more limited fashion. One of the ways it could help bolster the cybersecurity of the private sector is sharing information about best practices, sharing information about the threat. And I think that's what all the bills we're talking about would do to some extent without specifically saying so. I mean, where would the information from the government be coming from? A lot of it would be coming from NSA, even if it's not coming directly from NSA, because the NSA, through its dual-hatted mission, does have a lot of the best information, not all of it, but a lot of the best information about the threat and about what sorts of means can be used to thwart the threats. The other area that the NSA now has responsibility for, because it houses the new cyber command, a relatively new cyber command of DOD, is the offensive piece. Many people have said, you know, we're never going to have a good enough defense. It's simply too hard to defend. And I think Matthew was getting at this when he said, look, nobody's doing this well. And I think that's right. And part of the reason is, probably the biggest part of the reason is, it's really difficult to play defense given the fundamental architecture of the internet. And so some have said the only way to stop this best defense is a good offense. shut down the networks where the attacks are coming from. It's nice in theory. I'm not sure it's viable at this point in our history because it's too difficult to attribute the source of an attack or attribute an attack to its source. But at least theoretically, now NSA has that mission, and it could be responsible for defending us by engaging in offense. And then the last item on the menu would be the one that probably very few people would like to try, but it's at least a theoretical option, and that is to have NSA be the entity that monitors internet traffic, at least internet traffic that's coming from abroad, to detect the incoming digital bombs or the digital spies, as it were, and to be responsible for cutting them off. In some ways, this would be an extension of the Einstein project that the Bush administration designed and implemented, which has NSA intimately involved in monitoring traffic to government agencies. And I think the thought always was that was really a pilot program for a broader program that would include the private sector. That obviously hasn't happened. It's obviously controversial. But that's at least another theoretical role for NSA, which raises all sorts of alarm bells, naturally.
Let me put in a plug for DHS and the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, or the partnership. And I think one of the things that goes missing in this is one of the proposals that we advocated to Congress is that, you know, we've got that sector-based framework, about 18 sectors. I think it's sort of outlined in the paper that maybe's out front. We need to leverage that more. I think one of the things that would be harmed by elements of the legislation is you would have government being the regulator, not the partner. And I think we need to do as much as we can to make those processes work. I think we're trying to do that. Some of the legislation tries to do that. So just a plug for the NIP. And then in terms of the NSA, I guess let me, and then add to parenthetically, you know, our members tell us all the time, we need all those different agencies. You know, Michael's former employer, FBI, we need them. We need all the different Secret Service, all the different entities out there to work with us, to help us, back and forth. And in terms of the role of the NSA, again, you know, no formal policy position here. You know, we're thinking through these things just like everyone else is. But my sense is, you know, my constituency at the chamber, we've got hundreds, thousands of members. Some would probably embrace the role that Michael just outlined, a more active role. Some would be very much against it. And I think the current discussion, as you've seen in the press, as well as in, let's say, documents like the House Republican Task Force report, I think it's page 15, lists a page of questions that need to be asked. We're nowhere near getting to the point where we can kind of walk through those things and have good, easy answers. But I think that's one of the next frontiers that we're getting to. I think the kind of the current environment that we're in is, hey, are we going to regulate or not? What are we going to do to help business? How are we going to improve government's handling of cyber threats? So the next frontier is, you know, what kind of role do entities within government play? The other thing is, what are we going to do internationally in terms of developing norms? Those are kind of the two frontiers that we don't really get to in the current legislation because they're tricky. I think we're going to push them off until maybe a Congress or two from now, if we get to them.
So I would agree that the first purpose that Michael outlined for NSA would be appropriate and helpful. Having the NSA share the threat information that they become aware of with the private sector so the private sector can protect itself, and that the bill is setting up that leg of the information sharing to make safe channels for that to happen is fully appropriate and very helpful. But what we don't want is NSA to be the recipient of the information coming back. Under the Einstein program, actually, at least according to the public privacy impact assessments put out by DHS, it's US CERT, an arm of DHS, that's actually the lead arm, and NSA is only providing that role of sharing the threat information. They're not the ones that are monitoring even the civilian federal networks, at least as far as is disclosed to the public. And NSA, you know, we, I, 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 you know, this is an oversimplification, but you all remember the NSA warrantless wiretapping program. That's them. This is not the agency we want to be the first recipient of information coming in from the private sector of our personal electronic communications and emails. A civilian agency should be in that role.
So here's, well, we'll go to Q's and A's in a minute, but here's the sense that I'm getting. For the most part, people who've actually had responsibility for security in government from whatever party are in favor of a fairly robust regulatory structure. Michael, I know, is. Bill Lynn, who just stepped down as Deputy Secretary of Defense, an old classmate of mine, is in favor of the robust regulatory structure. On the Republican side, Secretary Chertoff, Michael Hayden. It's a pretty comprehensive list. Now, arrayed against them seems to be everybody else. There are business interests raising legitimate concerns about regulation. Regulation. There are privacy organizations concerned about civil liberties. There's what I'd call the black helicopter crowd, which is there's no one from that on this panel, but they're far to the left of Sharon. I mean, they think that everything the government
or right, it's a circle.
You're right about that. They think that everything the government does is an attempt to learn every secret thought that everybody has, so then we can all then be arrested for insurrection. It's a pretty formidable array. Yet we know someday we're going to have a swath of the Southwest looking like Katrina after New Orleans after Katrina. There'll be some outage, some attack. How do we get out of this? How do we move forward on this? Any thoughts?
I hate to be the pessimist, but we're not going to get out of it until there's a devastating attack. 9/11 woke a lot of people up to woke everybody up to the seriousness of the terrorist threat. The Patriot Act, as controversial as it was even after 9/11, all of those provisions were on the shelf at the Justice Department, developed during the Clinton administration. Those ideas weren't new. They didn't suddenly come to fruition between September 11th, 2001, and mid-October or early October once the legislation was there. That only happens when the stuff's already in the can on the shelf waiting for someone to open it up. And so I think it tends to be the case in a democracy under a constitution that is purposely divided so that government moves slowly and cautiously and deliberately. We're going to have to experience the devastating attack before we take controversial steps. I wish that weren't the case. I've been urging stronger action. Many people have, as you've said, for a long time, but I'm not optimistic we're going to get where we need to be until we already feel the pain in a big way.
I certainly hope you're wrong. Patriot Act being a perfect example from my perspective of how we do not legislate wisely in the immediate aftermath and disaster of an attack and don't think things through and build in safeguards. So now would be a much better time when we have the fullness of debate and can try and do this in a smart manner to balance all the concerns at stake and get something in place. But
I could not agree more.
I was just going to say, I hope that we at least, baseball season just started, right? I hope we focus on maybe getting a base hit. I think one of the things that we've tended to do with legislation, because it's popular and you got to gather a lot of votes to pass bills these days. If it was football season, I would have said, let's get a first down. But you know what? I think we've got measures out there, like the Rogers-Ruppersberger, that you can use as a means to move, start to make improvements, see if things work better before we layer on a new program that's frankly unproven. I think if anything I come back to is, how do you know that while we don't disagree with the threat, I might maybe disagree with maybe the potential severity of it under certain scenarios, probability, but I think we agree on the threat. What we do about it is what's key. I think what concerns me is we're going to maybe create a program based on passions and headlines, and then we're going to have a program that's maybe not effective. You're having businesses devote resources to compliance and things like that rather than saying, hey, I'm doing everything I can with a limited budget to protect my networks. And then we're going to have to come back every 2 years and say, hey, we don't really like this program because it's not working, it's not helping us. but we still have to give it policy and political support.
I think we'll go to some questions if there are any from the audience.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Frank. I'm with the law firm Sutherland, Aspel, and Brennan. And this sort of, the last question and answer sort of touched upon this, but I'll recast it as a little bit differently. One of the provisions in prior cybersecurity legislative proposals in prior sessions, but I don't think is any in any of the current proposals that have been talked about today, is a provision that in emergency situations, however defined, however declared by the president or his designee, sector-specific agencies would have additional authorities to take command, take charge, take control, coordinate, however you want to call it. They're all additional authorities. I'd be interested in the views of the panelists about whether such a provision would be desirable, what some of the potential pitfalls are, and, you know, what are the chances of that kind of provision finding its way into any of the current proposals.
Are you talking about what was called the kill switch?
Yeah. I don't know if that's...
Okay, well, that was... A term, which may show a perspective on it, that there were authorities basically for the president to shut down the internet. Now, that's obviously an oversimplification, and whether the president would have the technological capability to shut down the internet is a huge question, of course. But there were authorities for, there were provisions for that kind of authority before.
Yeah, I think that's how it got interpreted.
We are very glad that that is not in there now, that... We don't want to see that level of executive power, want to promote the free flow of the internet, and much more comfortable with the information sharing approach encapsulated in the current bills.
I was just going to say, I think that's right. I think that the kill switch sort of provision, that's gone from the Lieberman. I was just kind of flipping through a little bit of the bill here just to try to find it. I think the general reaction was that provision assumes that that program would be enacted. I think, if anything, in some of the initial feedback I think we gave committee staff is that kind of provision should be scoped. It shouldn't be something that should have a sort of an end date. And I think some of the language in there has provisions in about having to go back to Congress and get authority to continue sort of an emergency action beyond a certain period of time.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, Sam Wright. I'm a retired Navy JAG and attorney. In this information sharing, do these bills include maybe a new exemption in the Freedom of Information Act? You know, I tell the government, well, this is what we lost, and this is how we think they got around our safeguards, and then the People's Liberation Army Legal Department is making daily FOIA requests, and they get that information. And you know, even if it's exempt from disclosure, that doesn't keep the government from disclosing. You know, I think the Supreme Court's held that FOIA is a release statute. It's not a holdback statute. So even if the government has the right to not disclose something under FOIA, there's no cause of action if they disclose it anyway.
They all do include new FOIA exemptions. I can tell you that my colleagues that I work with on coalitions on open government issues, who take a slightly different view of FOIA than you do, are concerned that these are overbroad. This hasn't been our focus. From our perspective, what we would like to make sure is that the new FOIA exemption isn't basically so that if information was otherwise available under FOIA, because you disclosed it to some other agency under some other program, you couldn't say, oh, now I turned it over through the cybersecurity program, so now it can't become available. So that you want to make sure that the information does flow for the cybersecurity purpose, but that shouldn't be a backdoor way to get out of other FOIA obligations would be our concern. But I know that the open government groups who promote openness through FOIA believe that the existing provisions in, I think, all of the bills are overly protective, keep the information back too much, but they all do have them.
To my knowledge, all the bills have them. I think that's one of the key, you know, when I think of about two or three provisions each bill kind of has to have, Rogers, Rupert's Burgers, I think, considers information that's voluntarily shared, it's exempt from FOIA, it's considered proprietary information. I mean, if you are sending to DHS, another agency, sensitive information where, I don't know, let's say your general counsels were very reluctant that you shared in the first place, you want to make sure that that information is protected.
Any concluding thoughts from any of the panelists? Go ahead, anyone? Question then, any chance that an information sharing only act will be put to a vote?
Jamil's the best one to answer that.
I'm certainly not the best one to answer that.
Jamil, no. Sorry. I meant in the Senate.
Oh, the Senate. The Senate.
All right, never mind.
I would think there's a good chance of that just because that's the common ground across the two lead bills.
And Jamil, any insights on the House?
I mean, certainly I'm not the best person to speak to that. I mean, that's a question well above my pay grade. I mean, significantly above my pay grade. So I think there's a lot of discussion about what might be done in the House as well as what might be done in the Senate. And I think that's still very much an open question.
I was just going to offer, I think the only sort of freestanding information sharing bill is the Feinstein bill, S-2102, I believe. That bill is also embedded in the Lieberman-Collins bill. The Secure IT Act, the McCain-Hutchison bill, has an information sharing bill, one of its kind of four key provisions. So I don't necessarily see a information sharing only bill, let's say, passing the Senate, maybe moving to conference. Chamber would not be opposed to seeing the Rogers bill move in the House. We've said that. We're going to probably say it again soon. What I do think will happen is there will be other committees, a few, maybe more, that contribute pieces to that. But I think there's a strong chance that something will move, at least in both chambers. Whether or not we get to conference and something comes out of that and gets to the president's desk, I think is an entirely different question.
Yeah. So with that, I'll thank this panel for its help today. Time and thoughts.